From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. Agriculture and cultural anthropology in European history. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. Joan Thirsk of the University of Oxford and Hugh West of the University of Richmond. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with Joan Thirsk about her forthcoming book on alternative agriculture in England from the 17th century to the present. Following that, a discussion with Hugh West about his forthcoming study of the life of George Forster, who broke new ground in the 18th century as one of Europe's first cultural anthropologists. Here is Joan Thirsk.
Well, I am an agrarian historian, so I've been working on this subject for many years now. And recently I produced a book on the period 1640 to 1750 and in England, and realized how important these alternative crops were. When I say important, I don't mean that large acreages were grown, but they were important in paving the way towards another future for agriculture in England. So gradually I've come to appreciate how important the alternative crops were and the kinds of economic and social problems that they actually solved at the time that they were introduced.
Okay, well, what were the alternatives? If we have barley and corn and rye and things like that as the staples, name some of the alternates for me, and then we'll get on to their economic and social importance.
Well, the first ones to be tried out were industrial crops.
Meaning
oil. Oil for the textile industry in place of olive oil. Because olive oil was becoming extremely expensive. This was a period of price inflation in the 16th century all over Europe. And England had to import all its olive oil. So it became so costly, and also wars interrupted the supply. So people began to think about alternatives. And the alternative, which proved to be very successful, was rapeseed oil.
Now that's R-A-P-E?
Yes.
Rapeseed oil.
Rapeseed oil,
all right. Tell me, just spend just a moment on that. What is this stuff? What is it used for?
Well, it's an interesting crop because it's come back again in the recent period into England on a very large scale. Since about the 1970s, we've seen more and more rapeseed being grown. But now it's come back as a vegetable oil, a rather cheap vegetable oil that's used in the food industry.
Help me get a concrete image in my mind. Rapeseed. What does it look like? Apples, oranges, bananas, what?
No, it's a crop that really looks like mustard growing in the field. It has a beautiful yellow color. And it flowers in May.
How is it used?
It's the seed that's crushed for the oil.
And it substitutes, for example, for olive oil.
Yes, it's substituted for olive oil in the cloth industry.
I see.
Then it came to be used for lighting, and it's quite curious that there's a little town in the east of England, in Wisbeach actually, which happened to have a large number of oil mills for crushing this seed, because a lot of it came to be grown in the fenlands of England. And Wisbeach, that little place, was one of the earliest towns to have street lighting in the 18th century, long before you know, large industrial towns in northern England could afford an amenity like that.
Precisely because of rapeseed oil.
Yes.
Well, you say that it flourished for a time, and then a moment ago you used the phrase it has recently come back.
Yes.
What happened to it? Why was it not pursued as an alternative?
Well, it was a very successful crop for 250 years.
That long?
And yes, and during the 17th century you would have seen it anywhere from Yorkshire to Essex on the eastern side of England. And it continued to be grown until the 19th century, when they managed to bring in much cheaper oil seeds from other parts of the world, and they found mineral sources of oil as well. So it died out, and people had completely forgotten that it had ever been grown in England. And when it returned in the 1970s and 80s, the journalists were all fulminating against this alien crop, as they called it. That belonged more appropriately to Van Gogh and France than to Turner and England. And it's interesting that you find the experiments, for example, with rapeseed, starting in the King's Lynn area. And King's Lynn in eastern England was a port through which rapeseed had hitherto been brought from the Low Countries, and you find woad, which is the blue dye crop, which became another alternative crop, starting to be grown around Southampton on the south coast, because woad had hitherto been imported from Italy through Southampton.
Well, if we're talking about woad, if we're talking about rapeseed, and you classify those, Joan Thirsk, as industrial alternative crops, what other category might we need to know about? Are we, domestic alternative crops? What have you got in
mind? Let me tell you, the other industrial crops were other dye crops like madder and safflower. And mulberry trees for feeding silkworms to grow to produce silk. And then other crops were herbs for culinary use and also for medicines, very important, because great interest was being shown in herbs for medical purposes, and many experiments tried. And vegetables and fruits, those really were the things that diversified diet enormously in the 16th and 17th centuries. All of these crops needed to be very carefully cultivated and very carefully weeded. And that was the guiding advice given on all these crops. They needed to be weeded like a garden. And it's that that taught the permanent lessons, because gradually people realized that the productivity of land was much greater when it was cultivated like a garden. And as time went on, and these crops continued to be grown right through the 17th, early 18th century, people began to say, generally, 1 acre of garden land will feed as many people as 4 acres of farmland.
Goodness.
And that was an important lesson, the most important lesson of all, because in the middle of the 18th century, population began to grow again. And people turned away somewhat from alternative agriculture at that stage, because the price of cereals began to rise again, so that obviously it was necessary to grow more cereals for the larger numbers. And at that point, they began to wonder how they could take advantage of the of the lessons learned from the gardeners in the fields, and that's when you begin to get the really earnest experiments with wheeled implements in the fields that enabled farmers to sow in regular rows, and that enabled them to weed very carefully. And finally, you get the beginnings of the the agricultural revolution on the side of implements. Now, if we go back in time, there was yet another period of alternative agriculture. In the second half of the 14th and 15th centuries after the Black Death, because the Black Death killed about a third of the English population, and that meant a great fall in the demand for grain, and of course a fall in the number of people available to work the land. And at that time, the alternative chosen was to turn a great deal of arable land over to pasture and to increase sheep keeping for the wool industry. So now I've come to realize that we have actually seen already three periods of alternative agriculture in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think we are standing at the beginning of a fourth period.
All right, those would be the 14th and 15th centuries, the 16th century, the 19th you mentioned. Yes. What is it, what threshold are we, do we find ourselves upon right now?
In Europe, we are piling up mountains of cereals, cheese, butter, meat, which is far in excess of our capacity to eat it.
Mm-hmm. And how does that lead us into alternative agriculture? What alternatives are we looking at, therefore?
Well, farmers must find something else. They can't go on indefinitely producing all this food that is just stored away at great expense and mm-hmm. that no one wants. So farmers are already beginning to look quite seriously for alternatives.
For example?
Well, one of the alternatives I've already mentioned is rapeseed oil, uh-huh. and that has been very successful.
Uh-huh.
In 1985, the Royal Agricultural Society of England actually had a field demonstration of 19 alternative crops that farmers might consider. And that aroused a good deal of interest, but great care was taken to point out that one would be a pioneer in trying out these crops. It would be necessary to try small plots, because I think it's important, as we face the problems now, that we know that we have been over this ground before.
I see.
Now, it isn't very fashionable among historians to try and teach lessons to the present. So I may be wholly unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's necessary. In fact, I think it's ridiculous for us to be searching for an alternative agriculture now and not to know that we have done this before. And especially not to know that each time this has happened, enduring consequences have flowed from that effort. I'm not suggesting that any individual who now bravely tries to grow an alternative crop will be successful.
Uh-huh.
But on the basis of past experience, I am confident that something will emerge from this general experience that will be of permanent benefit to agriculture and to the use of the plants that we grow on mm-hmm. the land.
Just a footnote to our conversation, Joan Thirsk. Do you putter about in a garden? Are you speaking here from personal experience? Do you pass pleasantly hours growing things, nurturing them?
Yes, I am a gardener, but uh-huh. I confess that I'm not a very good gardener because I find it impossible to devote as much time to the garden as to my books. But I have grown some of these things. I've grown woad, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And once I took a woad plant into my graduate class in the university because no one knew what woad looked like. And I planted it in a milk bottle on the table. And it was interesting because although it was a growing plant, it wasn't that I had picked the leaves and they were fermenting, when they do make an evil smell. But at the end of the hour, it was very noticeable that there was rather an unpleasant smell in the room.
Bringing some reality into the class.
Exactly, yes.
Joan Thirsk is an agricultural historian at the University of Oxford. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Joan Thirsk worked on a forthcoming book entitled Alternative Agriculture, A 17th Century Perspective on Past and Present. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on 17th and 18th Century European History continues now with a conversation featuring Hugh West of the University of Richmond. During his recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Hugh West worked on a forthcoming study of George Forster, the 18th Century German social critic. According to Hugh West, Forster is noteworthy in the light of his travels in the South Pacific. Forster's observations of 18th century Tahitian life provided a basis for what Hugh West calls the sociological imagination. Here is Hugh West.
Well, I suppose one of the best tales that he tells himself, and it's obviously a tale that he wants to invest with particular symbolic significance. I mean, when he writes this account, he knows what he's doing to us, and this is one tale that I think it comes at the end of the voyage, and it sort of sums up the dilemmas and the problems that he's dealing with. And this tale comes not from Tahiti, which is sort of his central focus on this voyage, but from an outlying island who is sort of beyond the Polynesian chain called Tana, and they're on their way home. And Tana ostensibly is a bit less civilized than Tahiti. Forster knows that we're leaving. This is sort of the last farewell that we're going to see to people in the South Pacific before this sort of long trek across the waters to get home. And when they arrive at this particular island, it's never, as far as they know, been visited by Europeans. And Forster notes that the people are, if not hostile, certainly reserved about the relationship with the Europeans. And he tells us that over the course of time, they begin to break down this hostility, and they're very friendly to the natives, and they exchange gifts with them. And pretty soon, the natives become very friendly with them after maybe two or three days when they were initially hostile to these invaders from outside. And after this has happened, Forster goes off to explore on his own, on a sort of solitary walk. And he goes up the side of this beautiful hillside in Tana, this volcanic island with the kinds of scenery that we associate with that. And as he's going up the hill, he notes the people sort of in tune with nature, singing as they work. And he hears the birds singing, and the air is balmy, and all sorts of things like that. And he gets to the top of the mountain, and he falls into sort of a typical 18th century reverie about nature, or nature induces this reverie.
The sublime.
But the reverie turns out not to be what you might expect. There's a kind of surprise to this.
How's that?
What you would expect is a kind of reverie on the beauties of nature and oneness with God and a celebration of the primitive life. Well, what's happened is that we've sort of gotten the celebration on the way up the mountain, and just simply in his experience of these people in tune with their work. But when he gets to the top, he falls into a kind of reverie about the superiority of civilization over primitive life. And the course it takes is that these Europeans have come to these people who, in their primitiveness, are inhospitable. But having met these sophisticated people who know how to treat them as fellow human beings, they learn hospitality. They run through the course of history, shall we say, in 3 days.
They telescope
this history, and in 3 days they become hospitable people. And this has been done because of the leavening influence of these Europeans who behave rationally in these circumstances.
Or so the Europeans think.
Or so it seems.
Yeah.
And so he falls into this reverie, and having had these thoughts, actually a friend comes upon the scene and he shares his thoughts, and the friend agrees to these thoughts, and then they begin to descend the side down the mountain. And as they come down, they greet the natives, and the natives won't greet them. They jump into the bushes. They look.
What happens?
What happens is, as it turns out, they finally come upon a scene, and it turns out that one of the natives has been, so Forster thinks, wantonly shot by one of the Marines. Suddenly, this whole reverie has exploded, and suddenly he starts thinking about the terrors of European technology, about what civilization in some ways means. Perhaps we did bring hospitality to these people, train them in hospitality, but then we killed them.
Yeah, but even more than technology, he's got to worry about human nature. He's got to worry about, is it a them, us, Europe?
It is. I mean, he doesn't say, well, this is the way human beings are. They act in precipitous ways. He really, in this particular set piece, this sort of symbolic ascent, which is almost, I mean, you can think of it as it's a practically medieval allegory.
Yeah.
Petrarch's ascent of Mount Ventoux or something like that. In the context of this ascent, which is based on an actual real experience, he interprets that as a sign of the corruption of civilization, in a sense. And I suppose one sign of that corruption is that they simply have those weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore their technological skill has been misapplied.
Mm-hmm.
But the other sign of that corruption is that they don't have the kind of control over themselves that they ought to have as rational people. And so what you get out of this episode is this odd ambivalence or wavering that you get in Forrester, a sort of alternation between celebration of civilization and rationality and progress and so on. And then alternately, he sees the sort of dark side of it. And what helps him see the dark side of it is some of the favorable aspects of more so-called more primitive.
There's not much new under the sun, is there?
No, I guess. I mean, that's in a sense he's sort of the epitome,
yeah,
in an early stage of the dilemma which is going to face Western Europe and Western Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
But what makes it especially interesting is that the kinds of contrary impulses that he's trying to deal with have such general resonance. They both are part of 18th century culture.
Uh-huh.
And therefore the sort of 18th century society sort of being on the brink of modern life in a sense, and you have this mix of the Ancien Regime and then a new modern market society. He's right there on the edge of it, and he is someone who sort of shows the difficulties in a kind of raw form. But looking at them again in this sort of raw early stage, I think clarifies the situation, at least, if does not give answers.
What kinds of assumptions was he making? What kind of a mindset did he bring to this enterprise? How did he represent the Europeans on the one side, and what was he assuming about this paradise, as you called it, mm-hmm. life in Tahiti, mm-hmm. on the other side of the equation?
Well, I think it's not entirely clear that he had the assumption before he went, but it seems likely that it was built into what he was looking for, which was in a sense a sort of guide to morality and happiness in studying other cultures.
Uh-huh.
He knew he was dealing with something strange and something other, as uh-huh. we say these days, and he hoped to find some guidance to the way life and society should be organized.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a basic assumption. That's the way he defines his task as an anthropologist.
How did he look at this word progress? That is to say, you know, from what, savagery, barbarism into civilization?
Mm-hmm.
He had his own sort of, you know, equipment in those terms, and he was, you know, in projecting onto these Tahitians mm-hmm. certain mm-hmm. assumptions about mm-hmm. where they were on this whole, what, social evolution scale.
That's
Tell
right.
me about that.
Well, he inherited from the standard discourse of the day this notion of civilization as a progress, and you could take all the varieties of culture and sort of reduce them to this single history of mankind,
yeah.
which goes from the very primitive stages finally to the civilized stages. And the standard way of thinking of that is as a history of progress, in
mm-hmm.
which the Europeans are clearly in advance of the Tahitians in technology and social uh-huh. organization, rationality
uh-huh.
And things of that nature.
Is that arrogance? Do you look back on him and think of him as bringing a certain arrogance to this?
Well, it's not arrogance in that there's the other side
uh-huh.
To him. A side which we can see which also thinks of the development of human nature or the human history as a kind of degeneration.
Uh-huh.
Which is most commonly identified, let us say, with Rousseau in the 18th century, the notion that primitive life was better
mm-hmm.
than civilized life, and that it's all been downhill ever since people lost their sort of natural relationships with themselves and nature.
Degeneration's not a dirty word here, in other words.
Well, it is. It's a kind of dirty word for Rousseau, that is to say that civilization
uh-huh.
is unfortunate.
Okay.
And although Forster found Rousseau unacceptable because Rousseau admired the sort of solitary primitive man, and what Forster is after is the rules of sociability.
Man in society
and
right.
So on. He did think that the Tahitians in some ways demonstrated the proper social affections among people.
Uh-huh. Even though they weren't advanced.
And in this respect, they had something to teach the Europeans.
Yeah.
who had reached a stage, although of technological development, were way ahead of people. They had sort of lost their grip on authentic human relationships. And therefore, because they'd lost this grip on authentic human relationships, they were falling into vice and corruption and ambition and competition and war and so on and so forth, which the Tahitian life, he thought, was this simple, gentle, communal life in which society and the family were almost identical.
Uh-huh.
I think there are lots of reasons that would send him out there, and one of the reasons that would send him out there is sheer curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
A kind of acquisitive instinct that developed in the Europeans as they began to expand across the globe. And they simply, there was just a hunger for reports about these things. And clearly, I think there's no question that Forster expected to tap that market in a sense.
Yeah, but he wasn't.
And even to make money about it. So there's that, there's sort of that just fundamental curiosity.
Yeah, but he wasn't trying to improve the life of the Europeans, or was he in writing?
Yes, I do think so. I think that also that, if not to improve the life of the Europeans directly, clearly a lot of his so-called analysis of what Tahitian life is about in a sort of scientific voice has a veiled criticism of the way, and not always so veiled criticism of the way European life is conducted. So if you say, for example, that you emphasize clearly that class distinctions in Tahiti are not very clear, and that people get to talk to the chief whenever they want to. Behind that is a statement back here in Europe, people are living a life in which class distinctions are great and that the aristocracy is living off the surplus produced by the lesser classes. Or, even more importantly to him, I think, is not these political issues, although they're there, are the kinds of problems of social organization. Mm-hmm. So when he sees in the Tahitians, when he says the whole society is one great family and there's this great maternal care and concern for each other and so on, behind that is the implied criticism of Europe that we are living in an atomized society where people don't have these bonds with each other, that even within the family there may not be these bonds of affection, but surely society is not one great family.
Hugh West is a professor of history at the University of Richmond. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Hugh West worked on a forthcoming book entitled From Tahiti to the Terror, George Forster and the Sociological Imagination. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on European History in the 17th and 18th Centuries, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, the topics will be imperialism in Western cultures and 19th century Italian history. My guests will be Bernard Semmel of the State University of New York at Stony Brook and Marta Petrusevitz of Princeton University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Breaking new ground, discussions about alternative agriculture, and the beginnings of cultural anthropology. The topics this week on Soundings. Listen for Joan Thirsk of the University of Oxford and Hugh West of the University of Richmond. Alternative agriculture and the origins of the sociological imagination. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.